Welcome to another episode of Fukin Conversation. I'm so excited today. I have Ted Christou from Queen's University. He's the current Associate Dean of Grad Studies, professor of so many areas, curriculum studies, history of ed, philosophy of education. I'm really excited to have you on today. Ted, I was able to read the three works that you sent me, and I have so many questions. But before we delve into your work, I just wanted to know, how are you doing?
it's a great question, actually. It's probably the hardest question you'll ask in the hour. These are interesting times, and I think I'm doing fairly well. It's very difficult to be civic-minded when you're forced to be in isolation. It's very difficult to be engaged with the world when some of the news or the majority of the news is a downer. At the same time, I think it's some of the most important time right now is when hope feels diminished, when it seems like, as I quote Fishman and McCarthy in one of the articles that we might be discussing, is hope has fallen on hard times these days, and those are the most important times, I think, to be engaged, even though it's difficult, because I think our role as academics, but also as people and families, as neighbors, as so on and so forth, is to a large extent just trying to serve as an example of trying the best we can to be an example. At least that's what I try to do of how you can kind of live your life well, and it's been a great opportunity to practice being a philosopher. It's really easy to be a philosopher when things are going hunky-dory. It's now that you kind of test your mettle.
We first were asked to stay at home. I think we were on our way to Quebec, actually, to go on a ski trip with the boys. We do this every year. We go to Mount Sutton, and we were just... Lori was delaying that morning as we packed up, and knowing that most likely we were going to get a phone call to say that the ski hill might be closed. And so we started driving, and about an hour after we got over the Quebec border, sure enough, the ski resort called and said, hey, yeah, we have to shut down, and we're sorry. So we, you know, the boys, obviously they were upset, but we turned around and we were kind of like hesitant because we were, you know, weighing what was going on in the world and in Canada and whether it would be safe or not. And I mean, now seeing what's going on in Quebec, we're glad that they made that phone call and made that decision, because there tends to be, at least the week we go, quite a few Americans from New York State that go, and then some parents there for part of the time from Montreal and the surroundings. But, you know, when that first happened, I was the first few weeks, so I'm not sure if it was like that for you and if it still is, but I was watching the news every day, checking the numbers on WHO and their website, Ottawa Health, and tuning into the political briefings each day by the Prime Minister and Doug Ford. And I'm just wondering, has that been the same for you? And are you still paying close attention on a daily basis, like it's an obsession, or has that subsided? I don't know. I know it's subsided quite a bit for me, but I still try to check in once a day.
It's subsided. It's subsided, but not entirely, partly because even working from work, the nature of being an associate dean in the Faculty of Ed means that you're part of a bunch of committees across the university. So one of them is, because my portfolio is both graduate studies and research as the associate dean, I've got to attend meetings for both research and grad studies. And both have been like profoundly impacted by the shutdown. And so grad students, for instance, let's say you were a graduate student in education and you were doing observation in schools as part of your thesis data collection, or you were doing an RA ship because you needed the income and the training opportunity, let's say, and now the schools are closed. So what are you going to do with your thesis, and how are you going to earn your income? And with research, of course, interconnected, same thing, faculty are collecting data in schools. They can't collect data in the same way they were going to. There's an indefinite nature to the wait, and that's provoked a lot of anxiety. So what we have to do almost, what I have had to do is weekly attend meetings at Central University, so for lack of a better term, Central, because the Faculty of Education is out on West Campus like it is on various other places, geographically a little distanced from the rest of the university by a few kilometers. We gather now via Zoom, which brings its own wonderful things and its own challenges, sitting on your butt doing Zoom all day. But no, we've had meetings that involve frequent updates about where we are in research, where Kingston is in terms of its response to COVID. And thankfully, we've been in a little bit of a nice bubble. So nice bubble. Of course, we've had 60 or so people infected. No one's passed away, thankfully, in Kingston, and we've kept it under control. It also means that, you know, when the second wave comes and the third wave comes, we don't have a lot of immunity in Kingston because we haven't entirely really been impacted by it in terms of our numbers, at least the university population. Of course, like the rest of Canada and the world, we're realizing some of our most vulnerable people were the ones who were affected. Our homeless population has expanded. Yesterday, I was driving, took a little reprieve from work to go drop off my taxes finally, as the deadline's approaching. And I drove by a little tent city in Kingston near Bell Park off Montreal Street, which is the north side of Kingston. And some of the most at-risk populations live there. So a little tent city of homeless folks living there. And that's just a really stark reminder, not only that that sprung up, but that the city is just kind of ignoring it, because they don't really have options for these folks. Where are they going to put them and maintain social distancing? We do have some support for them, but social distancing and staying indoors is not for everyone. And then I guess just frequent kind of communications with grad students and helping us build supports to help them pivot their research and think about how they might do a thesis and get it through without getting the data that they had planned for a year and a half to collect and work on. So I've been at the periphery, and sometimes it feels like at the center of a lot of the discussion. So there's really no avoiding it. But I guess, were you on your way to AERA as well and hoping to make it to San Francisco?
Yeah, I was. And, you know, that the same thing is not knowing how to go about canceling a plane ticket or whether you should cancel it. And I mean, that, you know, in terms of what you just pointed out and the whole idea of the bubble, you know, and even carrying that over in terms of, if your biggest worry is about canceling trips with family to go skiing or to a conference, that's not that bad in relation to not even having a home to self-isolate oneself in. And, you know, I know you have lots of relations in Toronto and started your career there. The implications there as well as here in Ottawa for people who don't have homes and the impact that that has for them to be able to actually do the self-isolation at home. So I find it's hard to complain about one's own lived experience when you have the only things that you have to worry about are non-health related issues in relation to COVID-19, as opposed to the other people who are worrying about the very survival of their life in relation to it, right?
Yeah, Nicholas, I think that's totally bang on. Like my biggest complaint, you know, just get back to your question about how I'm doing, is that my hair has grown ridiculously long. You know, if that's my biggest complaint, it's just kind of a funny complaint, right? Because I was going to go to San Francisco, and I was thinking, yeah, I'm going to get a San Francisco haircut. I don't know what that means. You know, just in my head, a silly thought, like, I'll go get a haircut while I'm there at AERA. Well, there's no AERA and there's no things, and it's fine. But I think the expression that you felt is exactly the empathy, the understanding of what it means to be in a world where our own problems are not to mitigate our own problems. They are problems, right? But in a relative sense, being aware of the fact that there is more than us in a community, and that our collective security depends on everyone's security, that a democracy depends on every single person in it, because it's more than just going and voting every so often, right? Being in a democracy is, in Dewey's terms, a way of living. And so if you want to live democratically, then you have to attend to the welfare of everyone. And so it reminds me also that we're not quite living in a democracy yet. It's a goal. We're working towards it, but we're not quite there. You know, and take for instance, our elderly populations, right? When this first went down, I was in a meeting where I was feeling a little bit low that day. And I remember the meeting kind of started like, point out something that's really positive today. And I had run meetings that way, and I've attended meetings that start that way. And I think it's a good way to start a meeting. But I couldn't muster it. And for all that, I said, you know, we were still early and didn't know much about this. And I said, you know, I'm curious as a historian here to figure out at the end of this, what the historians will look back and judge us for having done wrong. It's a morbid kind of thought, but I thought, you know, the last time I can remember us having a new disease that we had no immunity towards, or, you know, or something like smallpox in North America, you know, people like Lord Amherst, just near Kingston, we have an island, one of the thousand islands technically, but just next to it, we have a big island called Amherst Island. Now, Amherst was this fellow who went around and handed out Hudson's Bay blankets with smallpox, right? So he knew what he was doing, right? And he actually manipulated that exploited the opportunity to spread a disease, to kill, to foster genocide. Now, I wasn't expecting in that moment that that's what we would be doing, but I knew that there would be shortcomings, whether of, you know, sins of commission or sins of omission. One way or the other, we do something wrong. And as I said before, I think we're realizing that what we've done in Ontario, what we've done in Canada, what we've done in the world for attending to our elders is terrible, and it's subjected them to, for lots of many different reasons, there isn't one. We've subjected them to vulnerability. That's you know, our death rates in Canada are largely composed of people who are in seniors' homes and those economically vulnerable and at risk. People who are struggling mightily because of no reason of their own, but because our social system wasn't there for them in the same way it could have been had we been able to foresee, had we been able to look forward and back at the same time and go, well, you know, crap comes, right? We better be ready for it. In fact, not only crap comes, we better be ready for it. Life is difficult, and we should never forget that.
I like how you look to the future. So you're thinking, even as a historian, you're thinking toward the future in terms of how, whether it's future students or scholars or the public might remember this current moment in time. And so there is on that continuum of thinking towards the future. And thank you for sharing those three pieces. I really enjoyed reading them. And I'm always, they always... reading the way in which you've situated the historical pieces that you're looking at, and whether that's Clybard's work or Blatt's or John Dewey and others, it always leads me down the rabbit hole. I just want to read more and learn more about the wider historical context in relation to how you're situating the story about these different characters and their contributions or limitations in terms of what they've done and within the scope of education and public schooling in Ontario. And I'm just wondering, from your perspectives in terms of that work, part of the backdrop is, well, there, you know, across the three pieces, part of the backdrop is transitioning from World War I to World War II, globally in terms of what's going on there, the Great Depression, and then how that plays out in terms of these wider conflicts and crises play out in relation to the classroom. So I'm just wondering, from your perspective now, experiencing what we're experiencing during the pandemic, how is that work informing the ways in which you're thinking about what's going on in schools today? So this shift to distance learning And I'm curious to hear your thoughts on, you know, if we talk about traditional forms of thinking about the curriculum in relation to humanist or progressive education, how are you thinking about this shift, or in some people using the term pivot, to distance learning and what's taking place in terms of the Ontario context in schooling today?
Thanks, Nicholas. I realized it took me years to figure out what I was researching, right? This is kind of funny. I don't know if you're like this. I mean, not only because we change and pivot, but you know, you for a while you just have lots of interests. At least I do. I'm definitely a dilettante. Like I'm my background is in the humanities, and I'm really fascinated with humanity, and I'm really interested with humanity at times of crisis. And that's what I've learned, is almost everything I write is about how we as human beings in our environments, in our contexts, in that little small bit. Sometimes you can generalize, but it's often hard to. How when the world seems to be changing and we look around and we go, oh, schools are the same. They line up desks the same, the buildings look the same. You hear this in a lot of popular TED Talks and blogs and videos and things. Like, you see people love saying, like, schools haven't changed. Well, schools have changed, but yeah, that's true. They also haven't changed. But we know that society is changing so very quickly, and it feels like we're always at the tip of the spear lately. And I think that's one of the reasons it makes the research question exciting, because we definitely today we're not in the Great Depression. We're not in Ontario at the time of World War I or World War II, or in the period in between those wars, where again the sense of irrevocable change was happening. But we do know that. There's a sense, and COVID has led us to this pivot, this change to online learning. It is a bit of a pivot, because in the last few years I've been bringing my kind of historical quotes and mindset to kind of explain how this idea of 21st century learning, now waning, but it was in its heyday 5 years ago, where everything was about 21st. Every school board was touting 21st century learning. The Ministry of Education was touting 21st century learning. Faculties of Education were touting 21st century learning. There was a group in Canada called C21, Canada for a 21st Century, that was made up of initial 10 founders. Seven of them were tech companies, were pushing government at the time, Kathleen Wynne, to move towards 21st century learning. That, you know, the world is changing, but schools haven't changed. We need to embrace technology. We're losing faith if we don't. And what the rhetoric, the talk, the actual ideas in them rhymed a lot with what I was hearing in the 20s and 30s around this thing called progressivism, right? The same kind of core arguments that we have to focus on the child. We need to focus on the individual, not on the curriculum. The curriculum should be modified for the individual. That learning should be active, that it should be about an engagement with things and not about a passive, you know, just reading, memorizing, writing exams. That schools should relate to the world as it is today, not as it was in the past when schools were created. These kind of dominant themes are kind of criticisms that schools were passive, that all they had to do was, a good example is history education, where a lot of people listening today, and you and I probably as well, have had history classes where people just gave you the book to learn, or, you know, PowerPoint notes, or maybe PowerPoint, other kind of notes to learn, memorize. This is what happened. Tell us what happened. Move on to the next thing that happened. You know, passive. Some of the old historical quotes would say that the knowledge barely stops in the brain long enough for you to think about it. It just has to come in and come out on the exam. That's the idea of passive learning. That schools had no relation to the world today. You know, some of the stuff being studied is not the stuff that affects their lives all the time, and we can probably relate to that. And that schools reinforce the curriculum and not what the child wanted to learn. And I think we can all relate to that. And that's this very tension between progressivism and tradition, right? This idea of when stuff changes, when the world feels like it's changing, and then we look at schools and go, hey, they haven't changed. Let's make some change there. Then you have this debate. And as one progressive, Joseph McCauley, I quote a fair bit because he's very quotable, says, you know, in all ages and places, there seems to be a man amongst mankind, you know, sick, apologize for the mankind, it's his word, a profound aversion to change, right? And I think when the world seems to be changing, not to generalize, but seem like we seem to have some tendencies towards either retrenching or embracing it. When we retrench, we go, okay, well, let's go to that grand old fortifying curriculum that got us through troubles in the past. Let's go to those great documents. Let's learn to read and math and science and tech and the engineers and that, and, you know, the STEM people, they'll get us through this. That knowledge is the most important. An old curriculum question, you know, for Herbert Spencer's, what knowledge is of most worth. But then you have others who are just like, well, no, let's embrace this change. Let's change schools. Let's get rid of that old stuff. We don't need that anymore. You know, and you see this playing out in so many different ways. I mean, the language of progressivism is new again. It's largely associated in American politics with Bernie Sanders, where progressive is a bad word, you know, or Hillary Clinton had embraced it with her very symbol of the letter H with the arrow pointing to the right. Like, it's about progress. We're moving forward. So it became a good word for a moment. And it largely depends on your orientation to what the change is, whether or not progress is good or bad. And so we're in this space where the world definitely is changing. And I think we have to be very cautious in the same way. I just said, like, I'm like, hey, let's be careful with this 21st century learning stuff. A lot of it isn't very new, you know. And I think the move to online pedagogy is gonna pose its own. It's gonna have its champions, the people who want to, you know. I get emails, essentially spam, but from universities every day asking me if I would sign up to some webinar about online pedagogy. Okay, great. There's a learning opportunity, but also there's a whole little cottage industry that will become bigger than a cottage soon, marketing it and telling us it's the greatest thing. And then there'll be others going, let's get off the computers now. And the middle ground is the difficult stuff we've got to live in. That's the messiness. It's that we now know we can do it. So we have to do it. But why? Why are we doing it? Why are we doing it pedagogically? Why would I continue to do this because it makes sense for the human being and not because I'm being at a distance? At a distance, I'll use it because I have no other option.
I really enjoyed reading your schools are no longer merely educational institutions, the rhetoric of social efficiency in Ontario, 1931 to 1935. And I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit more to the four themes that you take up in your analysis of the historical evidence that you review. And so you talk about there was more bridging between the home and the school, but it tended to be more during that era. There was an assimilational thrust in terms of the you kind of nod your cap to the increase in immigration and the shift from, you know, the logging industry, for example, that we experienced the tail end up in Kapuskasing in terms of the height and shifting towards manufacturing, especially in Toronto. I'm thinking of Toronto and the areas around Kensington Market and those areas at the height. But you also talk about restructuring of school buildings and the way schools are run to make them more efficient, and the impact that this had on wages and increased labor, especially for women, and competing now with men that were out of work going into the teaching profession, and also mental testing and the increase of testing one's intelligence. And in your other pieces, you look at the whole concept of thinking about the school curriculum in relation to strengthening the mind as a muscle. And then really in that piece at the end, and I'm wondering in relation to the policies that we see coming out from the federal government and provincial government, vocational guidance and training in many ways, or programming. And I'm thinking too, your reference to the work camps for men, and also the train that went up north as a form of moving school or school by rail. So I'm just wondering how we might think through, or how are you thinking through those four themes in relation to what was taking place during the Great Depression and the impacts and stress on the educational system, and how you're seeing things taking place today in terms of the 2020 pandemic and the stress. Like, so for example, last week we had Jennifer Tupper on, and she was talking about the stressors, the economic stressors on higher education out in Alberta, as one example.
Right. Yeah. No. I mean, this is one of the great this is a great question, because it's one of the things that you can learn. You know, you can't learn everything by looking historically, but you can learn some things. And one thing I can see very clearly is that depression made an impact on society, and it made an acute impact on schools. And so because of the depression, everyone in society had to adjust, right? So there's an analogy that we can start to draw, and through analogical thinking, I won't take it to its telos or its end. I'll just kind of like some examples. So a lot of the things that we take for granted right now in schools, in the school life, that everyone, I think, in Canada, or at least this is the study of Ontario, but can generalize, experience. Like, so for instance, when you go into a grade 7, 8, or 9 or a high school, let's say, and you have a homeroom, right? And then you go to math class, and then you get up from your class, and everyone disperses from their homeroom, and some will go to math, and some will go to gym, and some will go to French, and some will go to English, or whatever it is, right? And the teacher's there in that classroom waiting. And then when that teacher's done, that teacher leaves, and another teacher will come in and make that space. So there's, in a high school, we don't have this this kind of feeling that we have in an elementary school, where the teacher's in that one classroom all day, and they can put posters on the wall, and they can, you know, they're doing an ocean theme. They can convert the classroom into an ocean. I'm just thinking about things I did as a third grade teacher, right? That came out of the depression. So for instance, the idea of organizing and structure of the infrastructure of schooling changed dramatically. And it was about the maximizing the use of the school plant. It's very clearly engineering language that comes from the work of Frederick Winslow Taylor, who was a tour de force in this period in the US, and his ideas definitely permeated across the world. And he's a type, if you've ever seen the film Cheaper by the Dozen, I don't know if you have, but
yeah, I have.
It's like Turner classic film, yeah. Or whatever. You can probably stream it. He's a very sympathetic character, but he sits there, for instance, like he has his wife with a stop clock, and he buttons up his vest top to bottom, and then bottom to top, and then times it and says, I knew the secret was bottom to top. It's much quicker. So like these time and motion studies affected so they were meant for engineering plants and factories, but they began to really affect schools. So the idea that schools are like factories is largely associated with this kind of the evolutions that came out of this era. So because
I was just going to say, how can we make more pig iron more efficiently?
Yeah, exactly. So here's the problem. So there's no, obviously the depression, there's lots of problems, but one of them is that the school population explodes, because there's people who would normally leave school to go to work, but there's no work. So they stay in the school. It is, just to reduce it very simply for the purpose of the podcast. And so the schools are at capacity, and they start again looking to industry, and they go, okay, well, here's a bunch of, and they experimented. And I love experimentation, because it doesn't just wholeheartedly embrace something, it tries something. And I think we should always try new things. One of them is to actually create school shifts. So the school, they'll have some kids come in or some students come from, you know, 7 till 2, and then we'll have another group of students come from 2 to 6, and then that will maximize the plant. It's kind of like the GM plant that used to be in Oshawa, running 24 hours a day, different shifts. One of the others was actually creating this idea of maximum efficiency. So you've got students moving around the building and teachers moving around the building to make sure all the rooms and all the facilities and all the supports are always being used so that you have. So that was its, that was why it was done. It was done as a short-term measure. I don't think anyone's thinking this is going to change schools forever, but it has. You know, every high school kid in Ontario has got almost the same experience of having to shuffle around the school and go find their French class on the first day of school in grade 9 and all the nightmares that come with that, right? There are others. So in the same kind of efficiency mindset, it's not like this character in Cheaper by the Dozen. I'm going to point him because he's very sympathetic, but there's a crudeness to his thinking, right, as well. It's we want to help find people find work, right, down the line, like suited to their abilities. Well, okay, so mental testing comes in. That had started in the early budding world of psychology, you know, as it had split off from philosophy at the start of the 20th century. And they embraced ideas of science, the scientifically understanding what it meant to be intelligent, essentially, and categorizing intelligence. If you fall between this bracket and this bracket, you're of, quote, normal intelligence. This bracket and this bracket, you're subnormal, which could be then broken into things like retarded, which again have their own history here. If you're above that, you're super normal, or, you know, we might say gifted today, and subcategories even within there that would then rework into stream students. So if your IQ is of this category, guess what you're going to be doing for a living? In the same way in the military, you're not going to become an officer. Well, you're not going to become a lawyer, doctor, professor, so on and so forth. So this streaming, not ill-intentioned, but its implementation is scary. Right? If you believe, as the humanists did, who to some extent are the foils, I call them the foils to the progressives, these people who believe that the grand old fortifying curriculum would get us through the world, they actually believe that anyone was capable of learning anything. And it was terrible to stream human beings. Right? That's one other manifestation. Things like guidance. So Herbert Klebard in the US talks about the shopping mart curriculum, or the shopping mall curriculum, where once you know your IQ, once you know your aptitude, your ability, then you need another element. So they implemented vocational guidance. So vocational guidance counselors come into the schools and they work with you to go, what are your interests? What are your strengths? What are your aptitudes? They develop tests for those as well, but also through conversation. Here are the 5 jobs you should maybe do. Now, I had to do that in high school. I don't know about you, Nicholas, but that's a remnant from the Depression, where they were looking to try to help people transition into work more efficiently because they didn't think that without science, people would do that, I guess. It was seen as a progressive measure. So you've got your IQ, you've got your vocational guidance, and then outside of the really core stuff that, to some extent, the universities played a role in governing what high schools had to learn, and to this day they still do. Right? Most universities will say you need grade 12 English or grade 12 biology to get into a pre-med, or I don't know, all the prerequisites that might exist, but they exist. It's a kind of a top-down governance of what high schools are doing, because the universities then demand grades on certain subjects, creates pressures on the high schools to teach those subjects and to evaluate them and to develop grades, which then become our version of an SAT to some extent. You get a situation that isn't quite streaming, but it is intended to really help in the same way that it does is it creates structure that now we kind of do these things and we don't know why we've done them. I don't know that there's a single vocational guidance. Maybe they all know why they're doing it. Guidance has been cut and we lament it, but maybe we shouldn't. I don't know why we do testing the way we do it. There are historical reasons for why we have started to do practices, and when we continue to do them without the contextual reason for those or the logical justification that exists, then we're just doing it, and that's dangerous for schools to just do stuff without knowing why they're doing it. And not only that, to sometimes kind of double down on things like the recent math test that's been implemented for teachers in the province of Ontario. I don't understand the logic behind it at all. I think I can get the argument. I just don't think it makes sense. It's an idea that somehow, you know, I think maybe it's populism, maybe it's something else. But to stick to the depression area, the other element you talked about, tying together organizations that would connect schools and homes, that's partly one of the causes is the precariousness of work that I mentioned before. Teachers were lucky if they were, you know, they're largely portrayed as being lucky, at least in the educational journals, because their jobs were relatively safe. In fact, there were more teaching jobs because there was a higher population. It's one of the areas of society where people were employed. Not employed well, but it wasn't the space where, despite the Winnipeg General strike and the On to Ottawa track, where, you know, under Mitchell Hepburn's government in Ontario, the strikers were basically beaten up and sent back to wherever they came from before they could get their job done. Teachers were justifying to, they needed to just, they felt, at least the journals seemed to explain that they needed to justify their place in society. So they were doing home and school nights. These things, again, we take for granted now. Like, why do we have a home and school night? Well, it started in the Depression, where the teachers invited the parents into the school to start to break down those borders. School libraries started to be expanded, largely because of the advocacy of the humanists, who saw schools becoming increasingly tight and regimented and focused on disciplines, and said, well, where's some of the place for some of the great old books? Who's going to read Don Quixote anymore if they don't have to? So libraries, the advocacy for libraries grew, I think, largely because there were people going, this is going to be the last bastion of the great ideas in the school. The school library will hold the great, you know, database of knowledge of humanity and all those beautiful aesthetic, intelligent ideas or whatever they are, you know, different quotes they've had. And so we didn't have a teacher strike during the Depression. In fact, they actually worked to develop different kind of structures to relate the schools and the home life much better, which is a thoroughly progressivist theme, right? And so I mean, just to kind of end that discussion, I think, or transition, I think that this is what's happening now, is there are going to be changes. We're going to start doing things. We've already started doing some things at home. I don't know what it will look like, whether parents are going to play more of a role in some of the instruction, which is happening now because schools are physically closed. But the use of technology, there will be things that we implement that will stay. There will be things from this 2020 pandemic situation that 2029 parents, teachers, kids, academics, or 2050, let's say, they're going to go, why are we doing this again? I don't understand why I'm doing this. There'll be someone who just kind of go, well, why am I doing this? And they'll have to understand that, well, this happened in 2020 and we made some adjustments, or adjustments were made, and they stuck. They stuck for some reasons, many reasons, I guess. But these periods of shift, I think we're always looking at today. We're always like, what makes sense now? I don't think people are going, yeah, here's a chance to sneak something in. But for multiple reasons, some things we become part of the structure of school, largely because maybe they help with the efficient running of schools.
I was really thinking about my own background in classical studies and my love for Greece. You know, when I finished my undergrad degree, the first thing that I wanted to do, well, actually, while I was doing it, I traveled to Greece. I think the first time I was 19, and I just had a deep love affair. So I was going over to Europe with two friends, and we backpacked. But the ultimate goal was to eventually get over to Greece and see it. And obviously, at 19, I was too young to appreciate my time there, to kind of go see and study the different architecture and buildings. I did go see different buildings, but not necessarily have the acumen to pay attention to some of the things that really interest me right now. And then I went back again with my brother later, 3 years later, after I graduated with my degree in classical studies and a BA. And again, the same thing. We saw a lot of different things, and I really enjoyed it. But one of the things I remember, and I was thinking about this yesterday, that we studied in classical studies, was the whole concept of the city-state. And I was thinking about, you know, Athens and Sparta and the 50-year Peloponnesian War. And in many ways, just thinking about what's going on today and how cities and municipalities have been so much more empowered to make the necessary decisions around health and what public in terms of security. You take up the concept of security in one of the articles and what that's about. And so I see places like politicians in the United States, like Donald Trump, sending a certain message, and then you'll have the mayor of San Francisco deciding, like, you know, the president can do whatever they want, but for a city, this is what we're doing. The same thing in whether it's Regina or Vancouver or even Montreal. And so I'm just wondering, I sense a shared love of the classics, and obviously your research and your love of Greece. And I'm always hesitant to, you know, we've talked in the past, and I'm trying to, would you call yourself Greek, or are you a Cypriot Greek? And then what are your connections to, if I could call it that, your love affair for looking not only at the humanities, but the classics in terms of what's emerged from that intellectual history?
No, I mean, your first bit got me thinking about how the importance of travel and what we're missing. Right? In this current space of being socially isolated, which will pass, but the transformative nature of travel, that, you know, you and I aren't spring chickens, you know, but we're at the same time, like that.
Well, that was
several decades,
20,
ago, right?
Almost 30 years now. The first new time I was 19, it's hard to say that it was like almost 30 years ago. And saved up money from the summers that I worked. I ran a badminton camp up in Kapuskasing and then did other stuff and kind of set some funds aside. Obviously my parents helped me out as well, but I went with two friends over, and I mean, it was life-changing to go see at that age of 19. I try to imagine my sons just taking off from the house for 6 weeks with a backpack on to go see the world and learn about it. I mean, it's a huge privilege to be able to do that. I mean, slept on park benches and tents, yeah, but I mean, still to be able to do that.
Yeah, I wish it were, you know, if we had genies, and I would say one of my wishes to a genie would be to take every grade 10 teacher or grade 9 or 10, depending on the curriculum in Canada, it's mostly grade 10, take every grade 10 student and teacher to Greece and Rome when they're learning about ancient civilizations. And they all do in Canada, it's just depending on the grade. And just for a week, 2 weeks, let's say, and just feel the heat and walk through a market. And right now they're selling, you know, hokey little artifacts, but 2000 years ago, they were still selling hokey other things. They were selling, you know, honey that they sold as miraculous, or pots that were supposed to do all kinds of things, right? The market, the heat, the smells, the tastes, the energy, the vibrancy. And when you walk through the streets, you know, even though they're skeletons of the Parthenon or the Colosseum or wherever you are in Italy or Greece or wherever in the Mediterranean, you'll see this. Go to old Carthage. You'll understand it differently. It'll change the way you've ever understood those subjects. And for me, I guess to answer your direct question is, my identity is very hybrid. And I think we share this too, Nicholas, is like, I'm a Greek Cypriot Canadian, right? Cypriot identity is so confusing, right? It's a divided island, the idea of ethnicity, it is so complicated in a space like that, that's ravaged by colonialism. There's not a single empire in the Mediterranean that didn't make its stake in Cyprus at the time. And so, you know, Persians, Egyptians, French, English, English again, Ottomans, everyone. And so, It's very difficult to make very clear statements about my ethnicity and go, well, you know, I'm a pure this. There's no purity of in a space like that. What we do know is, you know, you come from a place like that that's divided, and its division is like the division between India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. And the division in large parts of Africa and the legacy of colonialism in North America. It's just sad and confusing. And so for me, every time I was able to travel, and it wasn't easy because my parents left Cyprus in 1974 after an invasion formally divided the island, where it still is divided. I mean, the early years of my life in Toronto, in Scarborough, it was a very different Scarborough, a very different Toronto. I mean, where they were spent in, you know, basically poverty. I didn't get my own bedroom until I was like, at 14, like sharing with my sisters. It was a different world, right? So identity growing up in Scarborough as a kid who comes from a place that has very complicated discussion about civic identity or even ethnicity is complicated. But yeah, I mean, linguistically, and language carries a huge part of culture. Linguistically, I think my first language was Greek, so that helped me tremendously in some ways with my quest of what it means to be human, because, you know, I had a kind of an open sesame into a lot of the ancient texts. And like you, I had an undergrad in classics and literature. But, you know, then I think I'm mostly drawn more to Latin these days and reading a lot more of the later Roman pieces. Another period I didn't send you any writings about was the Byzantines or the Romans after Constantine, when the empire Christianizes formally. That's a cute, another one of these pivots, right? Another one of these tremendous, like, what happens when suddenly your whole existence becomes a new religion? What does that mean for teachers and students and society? Like, there's no small shift to go back and imagine right now we're suddenly, everyone in Canada must become, you know, whatever. Some religion, and you can't teach if you don't, you can't be a student if you don't, you know, follow that. And religion being more than just going to ceremony. So, you know, I'm really interested in that period too, because it's one of the first major shifts that I have a linguistic access to through Latin and Greek that I'm able to look at and try to understand why for another 1,123 years in the Roman world, there was a dispute about whether or not you should read Homer. It sounds like a really silly question, but at the core of the question is, like, Homer wasn't a Christian. In fact, he's kind of morally corrupt. Should good Christians read people like that or not? And, you know, It's this question of humanity and our influences, and more so than what we read is how we live our lives. But we often, I mean, this is what I think philosophy is about. And I started with this question of philosophy as a way of living. Like, it's a good time now to practice philosophy. And I think if we pay attention, we'll see lots of philosophers in the public discourse. People who are living their lives well, and those are the people we should attend to, not the people trying to sell us new technologies or old technologies. That's one of the things I love about you, Nicholas, is I think you are a philosopher indeed. You care about things deeply, but it's not a rhetorical care. You see this with your commitment to the podcast, and I'm not praising my host for the sake of it. You're one of the people who I look to and go, you know what, this person who lives his life really well. And I don't mean has a yacht. That's not what I mean. I mean, just on a day-to-day level, tries to be meaningful.
Thanks for that. I think I've got a lot more to do in terms of especially yeah. Living well as a father during these times in relation to my three kids and in relation to Lori-Ann. But thank you for that. And I was thinking you made reference to Homer and the Iliad and the Odyssey, and I remember I had both those books when I was traveling around the Greece, and I think the second time Bob and I, well, I don't think we did, we went over over to Turkey as well and through Samos. But I had those two books. I don't know why I had so many books in my backpack because you're traveling. I had those two. Yeah. I had the Celestine Prophecy, and I think my brother and I shared the beach, and then we would trade books along the way. So it was an interesting dichotomy between the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the beach. But that, those and the Celestine Prophecy, those were the readings at the time.
Yeah. Gosh, you just take me back now with that Celestine Prophecy. That's the one. Yeah. Where there's no coincidences, yeah. Right?
And yeah. But so you mentioned this pivot in terms of your studies of the Roman Empire and its shift to Christianity. And one of the things that I noticed in the three works that you sent that, and you state this, like, look, I'm looking at the work of these different men and you're looking at their intellectual work in relation to the impacts on policy. And I was just struck that there were some, you know, you could see a nuanced leaning toward that, but it seems to me that during that time as well in Ontario, especially in relation to, you know, structuring, bridging that the relationship between home and school and the simulative context of the educational policies that were emerging, that they were deeply also informed by a religious ethos. Like I'm thinking of, the Protestant faith and even thinking in relation to who was in power at that time. So whether nationally thinking about Bennett and then even the juxtaposition in terms of schooling in Ontario and Règlement 17, is it? The disposition to Francophone Catholic, the Francophone Catholic schooling system. So, you know, how in many ways, I get into this conversation where the discussion around public schools is that there's the absence of faith or actually in some schools trying to become more open to different faiths, but always discussed on the premise of public schooling being different from Catholic schools because there is no faith. But if you really dig down deep in terms of the intellectual genealogy and that's informed public schooling, it's still deeply, from my perspective, informed by kind of a Protestant ethos. I don't know. Is it fair to say that in terms of the work that you've been doing? And
oh yeah, it's very fair to say that. I mean, that's maybe the nice thing about doing research is you never get to the bottom of it, right? You only have more questions, and it just connects exactly to your point about I still have lots more work to do. I mean, that's the first sign of wisdom to Socrates or Plato, voicing Socrates is. That's the classics before I answer your question, but you know, it's Meno's paradox is the minute you think you've got it, you don't have it. The minute you think you know something, you stop asking about how to do it. The minute you think you are living a good life, you stop inquiring into it. You know, it's crude, but it's like, let's say it's how to start up my computer. I know the three steps. I do it on automatic. I stop thinking about it. I become habituated to it. You know, I'm a good person. I do my best every day. You know, that's the antithesis of being a philosopher. It's to constantly doubt whether you have it. To be a learner, to be a researcher means to know that you still, it's the modesty that comes with research. It's that we realize how little we actually know. I think one of the things that I realize in my research, I've barely started to scratch the surface on, is how religion affects other than the Byzantine project, which is all about religion, is in Ontario, is I haven't really looked at it, but it's there. So Joseph Macaulay is a thoroughly Protestant character. The guy I quoted before as being a very progressivist, and it's very social gospel. It's bringing the kingdom of God to earth. And in my pedagogical creed, John Dewey says that. He says that exact same thing. And one of his last, you know, in his creed, a credo, first of all, is a belief statement. It's a religious, it's appropriating a religious genre, you know, a creed, to say, here are my beliefs, and my beliefs are how I will live my life. And his last one is bringing the kingdom of God on earth. Dewey doesn't talk about religion a lot after that, but you know, his early work is heavily infused by his belief that the world can become a space that is to some extent heaven-like. And I think a lot of reformers are doing this very work of trying to search for an ideal, trying to do something that's kind of heavenly, something that's going to bring goodness to the world, rather, is probably maybe a better way of putting it. And you can see that in lots of ways, in the school systems, of course. But let's say my institution, like Queen's University, began as a training ground for Presbyterian ministers. And actually, until fairly recently, every principal of Queen's was a Presbyterian minister. And so when a student convocates from Queen's University, they'll go through Grant Hall. Well, Grant was a Presbyterian minister, and when he lectured to students, and he did, he gathered them regularly. And we see this in the work of A.B. McKillop, a beautiful historian of higher ed out of Carleton. We see that he gathered students and he sent them on missions, and out of that cohort that Principal Grant was people like Duncan MacArthur, who the Faculty of Education at Queen's is named after. Duncan MacArthur, who was a historian, who worked in the archives, who became the Deputy Minister of Education, and then the Minister of Education, who introduced the 1937 curriculum reforms, which are kind of the high point of progressivism in the province. This idea of active learning, of relating to the schools, of engaging with the students' interests, and so on. So there's a really deep, and you can start pulling apart, he was this kind of Protestant, this kind of Christian, or that. It was a largely Christian ethos, for sure. And I would love to at some time, if I find the time, to really start figuring out, untangling some of the religious implications, or maybe how these individuals who I'm writing about as deputy minister or superintendent, it would be interesting to see if there's some themes that can emerge about faith, because definitely faith and hope are connected. And as I think I say pretty clearly, like hope wasn't understood as an abstract concept. It was actually an active part of how you engage with a world that's changing all the time. So hope is a disposition that's not a tool. That's a contemporary idea, but it's a very clear thing that helps you through your creed, through your belief system, engage with the world. And your religion was seen to be that way. It wasn't something you kept in your back pocket. That's something we do in our secular world now, where you be whatever religion you want. I don't need to talk about it now in the public sphere. You go home and do whatever you want. It's fine. But it was much more transparent because it was also more shared, I think, by the larger. At least it wasn't disputed in the sources, but it's almost taken for granted.
In terms of the three pieces, and so you have the other research that you're doing on the Byzantine era, and then you write quite a bit of poetry as well. And I know you've worked as the former editor with Chris DeLuca of JCACS. You've done so much for the in terms of different kinds of scholarship. It's very eclectic. And I'm wondering, like, when I was reading the three pieces, because I mean the writing's beautiful. There's a poeticness to it. How do you go about doing your historical work that you do when you put together these pieces, and what's the selection process? When I'm as a reader going through them, the sense that I get is it's through these different characters, and then they're nested in relation to these different macro contexts of whether it's a global, what's going on globally and then nationally. And then it kind of narrows to this character in relation to education and then the topics that are being taken up or debates or, and how they're being contested I get that. I see that, but I'm curious, how do you go about assembling, and these stories together? Where do you start? Do you start with the character first, or is it the context?
No, I think it's a fantastic question. I don't know how to answer it really. But thank you for referring to the poetry. I think it's about the story. I mean, for me, the driver is always the question. So here's Ted. I'm working in the Toronto District School Board. I'm a teacher, and that's great. I really like being a teacher, and I'm a third grade teacher, but I go into my classroom, and there's two third grade classrooms, and I go into my classroom and I close my door, don't close my door. And right across the hall, there's another third grade classroom. And I know from the staff room conversations, I know from, you know, bumping into people in the parking lot, I know from just like that classroom is running really differently than mine. And I'm sitting there, and in the back of my head all the time is, how come we don't have a common understanding about what we're doing in a third grade classroom? And now I might phrase the question differently, is do we need to have a common understanding maybe? But at the time it was like, why is it that I'm doing a very different job and these kids are getting a very different experience than they are in the same school across the hall? And it's kind of that thinking that led me to leave the classroom and go do a PhD, right? And it's that kind of thinking that is still kind of driving me in my academic research is almost the comedian, like the Jerry Seinfeld, who observes the world and goes, how come is it that the pharmacist always seems to be up on a pedestal? You know, I got to reach up to give the pharmacist that kind of weird observation that starts to niggle at the back of the brain. And so in kind of asking questions about why schools look the way they do is one of my common preoccupations. And so in order to answer that question, I'm always thinking storytelling. And that comes back to my, I guess, Greek Cypriot heritage, but most people have a similar story, is my mom is the storyteller. She is the storyteller. She can tell stories like the best storytellers, like Homer, I guess. You know, she told the stories to me, to my sisters, to my nephew, and always told it differently. You know, you take the same points and you weave the story depending on the audience. And so I think to tell a story about Ontario, you need to fill in a little bit more. It can't be once upon a time, because that's not history. It's storytelling. And one thing that distinguishes history from story is footnotes. And so you need to footnote, and that burden, the responsibility of the historian to be called false, as opposed to story can never be called false. It doesn't make claims about the truth. But to make claims about truth, then you need notes. And to make notes, then you need to start finding yourselves in archives and reading old documents. And I think when you start reading these old documents and you get deep into them, deep in the well, as Haruki Murakami shows in his novels, you know, they almost always have a strong protagonist who ends up in a well or on a mountaintop or someplace in isolation. And I have monastic tendencies, that's for sure. They you just start finding stories. Oh, this person's connected to that person, to this space, to this story. And then when you decide to tell the story, for me, it's largely that once upon a time becomes, here's Ontario in the 20s, you know, and you can't tell it all, but you tell those things that are essential, because you always have a word limit or a page limit, or, you know, you have to finish the story before your son falls asleep, kind of thing. And so this is what's going on economically. This is the kind of things that set enough of a backdrop so that the story then can make sense. And when you write about, let's say, Ontario in the 20s and 30s and 40s, at least the sources lead you to some of the same people. They're often males. Not always. I mean, especially around developmental psychology, you start getting a lot of teachers at the Institute for Child Study. But then the characters become a little bit more familiar, and the narrative itself becomes really fun to start to tell. Is how do you try to tell a compelling story? You know, is going to be incomplete, but I mean, the hope is that you want the reader to know a little bit more. And that was my goal as a teacher. Is I don't care if I'm teaching about baleen whales or about Canada and its trade partners. Is you want the audience to know a little bit more, that you haven't answered everything. You've actually done a crappy job if you've answered all their questions, because you've done away with all the curiosity that might come from it.
Yeah, I just I want to thank you for joining us on Fukin Conversation today and for telling part of your story in relation to the works that you shared and the work that you're doing at Queen's University as Associate Dean of Grad Studies, but so much more as a student of history and a poet and a philosopher. And also, I think it's really, you know, in terms of what you said about your mother being that first special, amazing storyteller. And for several of us, our mothers are our first storytellers. And with Mother's Day coming up, I can't think of a better way to end our podcast. So I want to just thank you again, Ted, for joining us today.
Thank you, Nicholas, for the opportunity. And it's always fun chatting with you.